Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Oncology Grand Rounds, as today we talk about some new excitement in gynecologic oncology, new agents, new treatment strategies, a lot happening in this field. So here's where we're heading tonight. For the first part of this, we're going to focus on ovarian cancer and specifically PARP inhibitors and the use of ovarian cancer. Our style, as you know, is very rounds-like. We're not going to try to cover every single fact. We're just going to really try to have some fun tonight and teach a little bit and really see a little bit about how this plays out in clinical practice. This is not just about the data and the trials. It's about taking care of patients. We hope we're going to give you a feel for that tonight. So before we really introduce the faculty in our usual innovative sense, I just want to take a second before we get started and query them a little bit about what it's like to be involved in gynecologic oncology today as opposed to even 5 or 6 years ago, Paula. It's really amazing. It seems like in terms of systemic therapy, it was all about chemotherapy, bevacizumab. Now we've got checkpoint inhibitors, PARP inhibitors, novel agents. Just kind of curious, Paula, what it's been like for you to see this change, particularly over the last 3 or 4 years?
I started over 30 years ago, and my patients with advanced ovarian cancer lived 2 years. And now the survival is 8-10 years. And we say, we hope to keep you alive long enough to die of something else. But now that we have PARP inhibitors and targeted therapy and molecular profiling, we're not just treating a tumor, but very individualized care. So it's very exciting.
And Jenny, it's really amazing when you look across. In the past, we would go to ONS and we do all this stuff in 3 or 4 days, and it really just hit you how many new things are coming into the all parts of oncology. I mean, there's nothing. You know, bladder cancer we're going to do here. There's 5 checkpoint inhibitors, an antibody drug conjugate, and a TKI all have been approved in bladder cancer. So everything is kind of exploding. Jenny, what's it been like for you to see all these new agents come into your practice?
I mean, it's been really exciting. One of my mentors, when he had a recurrent patient, an ovarian cancer patient, he would say, if we were having this conversation 10 years ago, it would be a very different conversation. So I think it's an exciting time to be in gynecologic cancer.
You know, the other thing that we've seen, Shannon, we're going to talk when we get into the PARP section about genomic profiling, and particularly looking for germline mutations, which have implications not just to the patient. Now, of course, if you have a patient with a BRCA mutation, you're going to think about a PARP inhibitor, but also implications to the family. Any comments on that, Shannon, and what you've seen in terms of being able to detect germline mutations, then pick them up in the family and actually prevent cancers?
Well, I mean, I think it's been really empowering. We knew for a long time that we had to be doing germline testing for BRCA, and yet you would see report after report that the penetrance of actual testing was like 20%, 30%, 40%. You knew we were missing these patients. And now that we have all these treatment options, I think it has really elevated that testing into the upfront. And then we're being able to reflect that back to the family. So not only is the patient benefiting from a treatment standpoint, but then we can do cascade testing of the family members and determine if anyone else is at risk and potentially prevent cancer. Because obviously the treatment works, but we'd ideally like to prevent the cancer from coming to begin with.
Yeah, that's the best case scenario. And the final thing I want to mention before we kind of get started, Dave, is how clinical research has entered the picture in gynecologic cancer. Because medical oncology has lots of trials and is very deeply ingrained. Gynecologic oncology, urology is another one that's kind of a specialty out there. But what we've seen now, to me, it looks to me like the last few years, a lot more new agents coming in to gynecologic cancer. And some of these new agents actually patients benefit by. Phase 1 studies where the first patient gets a drug, you see benefit. Again, any comment, Dave, on what clinical research is like in the field, again, compared to maybe 5 or 8 years ago where it was maybe chemo A versus chemo B?
Right. I mean, the opportunity to have these agents and really see prolongation of life and improvement really gets patients excited. But really, when we get the practitioners excited, when somebody comes in my phase 1 clinic and I end up keeping them for 3 years because they have disease control, man, my partners are really itching to get those patients. And then you talk to people around the community and they're trying to get them into the phase 1. In the past, phase 1 was last ditch. I'd often see consults, hospice or phase 1. Not anymore. I mean, you get platinum resistant, you better be getting a consult in consideration for phase 1.
As I mentioned, we start out talking about PARP inhibitors, and then we'll move on to talk about checkpoint inhibitors. So let's talk about PARP inhibitors and want to maybe kind of just get a broad overview of what happens when someone presents with ovarian cancer. And Jenny, this is actually a slide that Shannon used. And I should mention all four of the faculty have done presentations. We're posting them online this summer. We'll tell you about it. But this is a slide that Shannon put together, Jenny, but I thought it really provides an overview of sort of what direction people can go when they present with ovarian cancer. Can you talk about the typical clinical presentation, Jenny, and then these two routes that patients can take?
Sure. So typically, a patient that presents with a new ovarian cancer is in their mid-60s, you know, newly retired. Unfortunately, it's usually a very slow process in the fact that it can take time for their symptoms to be discovered because they'll go to their PCP and they'll have general complaints such as abdominal distension or some constipation, stuff that we all have from time to time. But as the months go by, it gets worse and worse. And then unfortunately, sometimes they'll end up in the ED or they'll get a CAT scan eventually, and it will show usually advanced cancer at that point.
And often this is confined to the abdomen. So debulking surgery is often considered in that situation. Most patients will either get debulking surgery or they get neoadjuvant treatment systemically and then debulking surgery. And after that, often get what I would call adjuvant chemotherapy, Shannon. And now we're talking about a new type of drug, very different than chemotherapy. We're talking about PARP inhibitors. And I'm just kind of curious how you explain. I love this diagram. I know it's very basic, yeah, but I'm just curious how you explain to a patient like what PARP inhibitors are and why they're helpful to treat cancer.
Yeah, I like this diagram too. The table, there's one I talk to them about is a train on a track. So the DNA is a little track and you've got your train cooking along. And if you get a break in the track, that PARP is what comes and fixes that track. But if you have an issue where you block that PARP and it can't fix that single, then you collect two breaks. So both parts of the track, both sides of the track are now broken. And that's what we typically would use homologous recombination or this HR repair. So if you've got normal functioning HR repair, no problem. Your cell will repair its DNA and it will be fine. But if you have a defect in your ability to do that double-stranded break repair, that you have a homologous recombination deficiency, then that single strand becomes a double strand. And then that double strand, that double track, train falls off the track because it never gets fixed. And people really seem to understand that. And now we used to just tell that story around BRCA mutation being the reason for homologous recombination deficiency. But now there are a number of different aberrations that can cause that. And so that helps to understand why we're doing all this testing up front, not just for BRCA, but other forms of homologous recombination deficiency.
So Dave, this is another diagram that depicts DNA repair, which is really what PARP is all about, and the single and double stranded breaking. Do you want to take a crack? It's, again, just at a broad conceptual level. 90% of the time when I see these kinds of diagrams, I don't even understand them, but you can try to make sense of it to me. How does DNA repair work, and why do you get an advantage when you use a PARP inhibitor in cancer?
I've made a career surrounding myself with people much smarter than me, and Shannon Weston is one of those people. She's a wonderful collaborator from going back from years, and I think she just described it perfectly. You have this mechanism of repair which doesn't work, and when you get that repair, you get the second break, those cells die. So when we look at this and we try to overcome those, what's always challenging for me, Neil, is that how do you then explain we see PARP inhibitors work in these proficient patients. So for me, trying to get through this and really seeing that we have damage, that damage then normally is repaired. When we bring the mechanism into blocking that repair, it doesn't happen and the cell dies. So it's almost a circular argument as we go forward with these from the cells which are deficient in that DNA repair to then blocking that so the cells actually die. And these are cancer cells, so we want them to die.
So, you know, maybe we can start to see how this plays out in terms of clinical research and patient care. Because for all these theoretical mechanisms, the bottom line is if you're giving a new drug to a patient, you want to figure out what are the risks and what are the benefits. And that's really what we're about to separate out. So, you know, the biology, I spend a lot of time talking about, but it relates to the ability of the cell to repair DNA. But more importantly is, okay, we take that theory, and now you have these agents, how do you utilize them? And Shannon, these are some of the major clinical trials that have looked at this question over the last, particularly over the last couple of years, particularly as it relates to PARP inhibitors. On the left, we have an older trial that looked at the use of bevacizumab. We'll talk a little bit about where Bev fits in. But what we're really focusing now is on the newly diagnosed patient, presents with disease in the abdomen, let's say has surgery to debulk it, has chemotherapy, also often carboplatin paclitaxel to reduce the chance of it coming back. And now the question is, can more be done? And we're going to go through the four trials to the right where PARP inhibitors were introduced as maintenance therapy to try to improve the outcome. But Shannon, where were we before PARP inhibitors in terms of outcome for these patients? They had surgery, they get chemotherapy, some of them get bevacizumab. What was the prognosis of patients in that situation before we had PARP inhibitors?
Sure. I mean, basically what we would say is that about 80% of patients with a combination of surgery and chemotherapy would end up getting to the so-called no evidence of disease. And it was really a clinical complete response. So for a proportion of those patients, they probably still had disease that we just couldn't see on imaging. But 80% of them would get to the completion of their therapy and have no evidence of disease and would go on to surveillance. On average, it would take about 18 months to see a recurrence, and we'd see about 70 to 80% of the patients recur depending on their stage, depending on if they had an optimal tumor reductor surgery and other factors. And so clearly we like that early benefit, that early response, but we weren't keeping people alive. Their five-year survival was only about 30%. And so that's why there was a lot of push to look at new maintenance strategy, try to extend that benefit and extend that survival.
And if you think back to the first one of these symposia we did a couple of weeks ago on breast cancer, we were talking about adjuvant therapy. In breast cancer, you have somebody who has 8 or 9 positive nodes, they have an 80, 90% chance of recurrence. And that's kind of what a typical patient with ovarian cancer is looking at. And so now the question, Dave, is can we identify patients where we can lower that risk or delay the patient having disease progression? So let's just walk through some of the trials that were done to see whether or not you could get better outcomes. And the first one, I guess it was about, let me think, a year and a half ago, not that long ago, a year and a half ago is when everything changed. That's not a long time ago. So what did they look at in this trial, Dave, the SOLO-1 study?
So this was really the first trial in the upfront setting, looking at patients with BRCA mutations. Now, germline BRCA mutations and somatic BRCA patients were allowed, but only a couple patients with somatic mutations went on because we weren't testing the tissues that often. It was a 2-1.
Did you just clarify, though, I meant to ask this before. You mentioned germline and somatic mutation. Can you clarify what the difference is?
So when we're talking about the genes or germline, this is what Shannon referred to earlier, when we're really identifying those patients who have a genetic predisposition. But we found out there's probably as many patients, or at least half as many patients, that don't have the BRCA mutation in their genes, but actually have them in the tissue or somatic mutations. And so that's why it's so important, in my opinion, that not only do we test the genes, but we also send the tissue off for somatic or tissue testing, also looking at mutations within there. So in SOLO-1, we took all those patients, though, all except for a couple, had germline, and we randomized them 2-1. In almost all these trials, the randomization was 2-1, placebo-controlled prospective trial. And looked at patients who had treatment then for 2 years on SOLO-1. In those patients, we saw truly miraculous results and improvement in patients who received the PARP, really changing the bar and leading to approval of olaparib in the frontline maintenance setting for patients with BRCA mutations.
So, and we knew that, and actually the chance of recurring was decreased 70%, which is a gigantic drop in breast cancer. A lot of the therapies we've talked about, maybe it'll drop at 20, 30% at a time. This is a huge drop in these particular patients. Now, Shannon, when you look at newly diagnosed patients with ovarian cancer, what fraction have these either BRCA, germline, or somatic, or other mutations that make them very sensitive to PARP inhibitors?
We know that approximately 15 to 20% probably have the germline BRCA mutation, and then there's additionally maybe another 10, 7 to 10% that have a somatic BRCA mutation. We're still learning about a lot of the other pathway members in that homologous recombination deficiency pathway. It doesn't seem that they're all created equal. There are certain like RAD51D, RAD51C, which may provide a benefit from PARP. And then there are others that might not, that even though they have that aberration, they don't get the benefit from PARP. So it's probably approaching about 30, maybe 40% of the patient population that will have a benefit.
So if you see how this rolled out over the last year and a half, first you have the Solo 1 study that really focused on the people that you would think would be most sensitive, and you saw this fantastic benefit. But then let's just briefly take a look at the other trials that came after Solo 1, and actually three of them were presented all at once last October in Europe at the ESMO meeting. First, you had the PRIMA trial. And the awesome thing about PRIMA is they took everybody. We just talked about Solo. That was just BRCA germline, so a small fraction. They took everybody, gave them the PARP inhibitor and niraparib, and overall, they benefited. Now, we can argue about whether there were patients in there who didn't benefit, but clearly, as a group, you saw PARP inhibitor, and we'll talk now, it's approved regardless of mutation status. So that was the other thing. The other thing, Paula, that I thought was interesting about this, and we were chatting about this before, is that in this trial, the PARP inhibitor, niraparib, was given for 3 years. And whereas in the olaparib study, it was given for 2 years. Just kind of curious, we'll talk later on about side effects and getting people through the therapy, Paula. But any comments on trying to get somebody through 3 versus 2 years of a PARP inhibitor?
Well, I think originally, because olaparib has been used the longest, the initial clinical trials were until progression. So unless they had unwanted toxicities, you gave that until patients progressed. And then I think with all the research coming out and showing that patients are at risk for MDS or AML, they reevaluated and said, let's just give this for 2 years. So I think with niraparib, we may find that we haven't been using it as long, but that may change whether or not they pull back and say 2 years is enough.
It will be interesting because these approvals are just like a couple weeks ago. So people are just, nobody's even really started, I think, to use niraparib. But in any event, we're going to go to a case in a second, but just to put up a couple more trials, just kind of see what it is that people have been talking about. So this is a huge study. Now it opened up PARP inhibitors to everybody. People with BRCA, they did better, but even people without it did well. This is another incredible study where I mentioned bevacizumab that had come into the treatment of some patients with ovarian cancer up front. Here they combined olaparib, the PARP inhibitor, and Bev. You saw a much better result than Bev alone. Now there's another approval again a couple weeks ago. So now you have the option of giving olaparib and bevacizumab, another option. And finally, at that same meeting, there was a trial presented where another PARP inhibitor, veliparib, and this was different. It was actually given with the chemotherapy. The other ones were given afterwards. So they gave it with it, and then they gave it as maintenance. And these studies all showed benefit. It's kind of hard to compare between them. But we're going to kind of go through the way all this incredible research now is translating into patient care. And here's the two approvals, niraparib, April 29th, and then May 28th, which I guess was fairly recently. Losing track of the days of the week, the days, et cetera, here like everybody else.
Yeah.
But let's get down to how this actually plays out in reality. And Jenny, you have a patient who kind of looks like they kind of went through a pretty typical progression that a lot of people are going to be going through, are going through right now, have been going through for the last year. What happened with this 72-year-old woman?
Yeah, so I spoke earlier about the typical presentation. She actually had a more abrupt presentation with some rectal bleeding, came into the ER, her CA125 was elevated, a biopsy did confirm ovarian origin. She had upfront cytoreductive surgery and then carboplatin and paclitaxel for 6 cycles, which is our standard. She did experience some thrombocytopenia during her initial chemo course, which will be important for later. That was her CT scan and the ED that's showing right now.
That's a big mass there that the arrow is pointing to.
Yes, big mass. And then her genetic testing came back negative, her germline, but she had somatic, so the tissue had a BRCA mutation from the tumor. We were able to put her on maintenance olaparib, which she started earlier this spring. We did start her at lower dose because of the thrombocytopenia she experienced during her initial chemotherapy, and we've had to do some dose reductions and pauses along the way, but she's doing great. She's able to travel to Florida and tolerating the maintenance therapy, the olaparib, much better than she did the initial chemotherapy.
So the theme, you know, I remember when we used to do these things one after another, we put up slides. These are the new agents we're talking about this week. There'd be like 70 of them. You know, it's really amazing how many new things there are to talk about. But in terms of PARP inhibitors, I guess the two things that you hear the most about in terms of tolerability issues, Paula, are cytopenia. So particularly anemia and thrombocytopenia, which this lady sounds like she needs a little adjustment to deal with. And also GI problems. Now, Jenny, did this lady have any nausea or upper GI problems?
She didn't. I know that's one of the main three side effects. And I've definitely seen some diarrhea as well. But I think for the most part, people tolerate the PARPs really well in terms of nausea. You start out on maybe some ondansetron prior, and then people kind of start to forget to take it. And then their body gets used to the drug and they, in general, do okay. What do you think, Paula?
Yeah, I do remind them and educate them. It's pretty much a class effect. And like you said, some people just sail through it and others have a more difficult time, just like with chemotherapy, different risk factors. So we do give them anti-nausea medicines up front. And it usually lasts for about 2 weeks and just kind of plateaus, and whether they adapt or tolerate. But I think it is important to remind them that that is a common side effect, but it does improve over time.
Jenny, any comments about this patient in terms of how it was different to take care of her than, say, somebody else in the same situation? What's important to her? How does she spend her time?
Unfortunately, a lot of our patients, they're newly retired. They're looking forward to spending time with their grandkids and their kids. Maybe they have a lake house or they are wanting to travel, and this was her to a T. And so she did have a difficult course during her IV upfront chemotherapy. So just getting her through that and knowing that we could get her on this maintenance track afterwards was kind of like a light at the end of the tunnel, a goal for her to get to. And we told her all along that she'd likely tolerate the PARP much better. And thank God she did. And she was able to, like I said, go to Florida and visit with her grandkids and whatnot. But unfortunately, that's kind of a typical scenario that everyone has something special to their lives, and we try to tailor their treatment around it in order to get them through so they can live that life that they want to.
These meetings, these webinars, everyone is a different experiment. We're trying to figure out what the best way is to meet your needs. And incidentally, I would love it for you to just email me, drneillove@researchtopractice.com. Send me an email and tell me what you like, what you didn't like, how we can make this better. And we could really use some help. We could really use some input. Tell us how to make it better. I saw there was some back and forth about actually the next thing we were going to talk about. So we have a case, we have the trials. Now I want to dig into the clinical pragmatics. And I put together a bunch of things that I heard from you all when I spent the time interviewing you all. And I'm going to throw it back to you and see whether you agree with what I heard from you all. So I saw there was some interesting back and forth in the chat room about testing. And I guess one thing that I see kind of looking from 30,000 feet as looking at all these cancers, Dave, is the fact that theoretically you can do germline testing. You can just look for BRCA, or you can look for a whole bunch of stuff. That's a panel. You can look for BRCA in the tissue, or you can send a comprehensive thing and look for 3,500 genes, including BRCA. I guess the bottom line is, theoretically, if you want to catch everything, not worry about spending money, et cetera, you could do all of them. Is that right, Dave? In other words, you're going to miss a few patients if you just do germline, miss a few if you just look at the tissue.
Well, I think there's a couple of ways to look at this. The multiplex testing identifies mutations beyond BRCA. We have just recently heard, and I've had the honor to publish, on the importance of RAD51C and D. And I don't want to get too much in the weeds on all the different mutations, but there are some mutations that act just like BRCA that we absolutely need to identify from a treatment standpoint. But what else? If I just check somatic, that's going to identify patients with BRCA. But when the patient's sitting in front of me, I'm not going to be able to tell her if this is only in her tissue, a somatic mutation, or is it also in her genes, which, by the way, then her children may be impacted or her brothers and sisters may be impacted. And so then we have to wait another couple of weeks to get the germline back. In addition, the data is really unclear, but we know we're going to miss some mutations, especially the large rearrangements or the large deletions or those just pinpoint mutations if we just look at the tissue, while getting the germline or the genes and the tissue will let us catch all those patients who are going to need family counseling, cascade testing, and huge impact on potentially the decisions I make in treatment.
So really astute question in the chat room. Someone said with niraparib, we mentioned that the trial where everybody benefited. So the question is, why do you have to even test? Just give it to everybody. But one thing is, it is great to know what kind of benefit you're going to get ahead of time. You know, maybe it's going to factor into your decision whether to even use it or not. And that gets back to this question that we asked here, which is, what's the minimum that has to be done in every patient with ovarian cancer, regardless of whether they have a family history? And I would answer that question, Jenny, to say BRCA germline, that you have to look for BRCA germline. Now, it really makes a lot of sense to look at somatic. You can do panel. Most investigators look for everything. But at a minimum, when you see this kind of benefit that we've just described, Jenny, agree or disagree? I'm kind of like forcing you to agree. But
no, I do. I agree. I agree.
Because, I mean, not everybody has access to sophisticated technology, but I think everybody can get a BRCA germline test on.
Yep. So we germline test all of our patients for BRCA mutations. And then if they are negative, we're kind of in the middle of figuring out what exactly we're going to be doing. But so far, if they're negative, then that's kind of when we do somatic. Or later down, if they progress, that's another time you could do a snapshot or take some of their tissue and look at it.
And actually, there's a great slide in Shannon's deck that talks about the fact that you can kind of do this reflex approach where you can just do germline first, then see if it's negative, then you do. So, you know, again, I refer you to Shannon's talk. But Shannon, it gets down to the issue, and our programs for medical oncologists, we're trying to sort this out as well. Pretty much the question, okay, you're going to get the surgery, you're going to get the chemotherapy, but are you going to get a PARP inhibitor? And if so, which one? But also, are you going to get Bev?
Right.
And are you going to get both? So I guess it brings up what I have been hearing is it sounds like the decision about Bev and the decision about PARP are kind of independent. I don't know if you would agree with that, Shannon. It kind of reminds me, again, when we were talking about ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer, you decide about hormones and you decide about chemo. It kind of seems like, and in terms of Bev, we had this question that we asked the audience in terms of when Bev is used. What I've been hearing from oncologists is they think about Bev when people, for example, have ascites, where they have a lot of disease, not option A necessarily, where they have optimal debulking. So what is the kind of patient, the clinical situation, Shannon, where you maybe are going to be thinking about including bevacizumab with chemotherapy and as maintenance, regardless of whether you're going to give a PARP inhibitor, Shannon?
Yeah, certainly. You're exactly right. You make that bevacizumab choice pretty upfront before you even may not know the results of your germline and somatic testing. Bevacizumab has an indication with chemotherapy for all comers in the upfront setting, but there's many of us that do use some clinical features, and ascites is one. The other thing I really think about is if I have a patient that has stage four, you know, there was arguably a subset analysis, but we have to use something to make our decisions. And that subset analysis showed that when we give bevacizumab with chemotherapy to a stage four patient, her survival looks like a stage three patient. And that's pretty exciting because we know we do really poorly with those patients that are the highest stage. And so that's the population that I tend to use bevacizumab with. And now given these new data around PARP, I'll use my testing to determine if I'm going to add PARP to her bevacizumab. Am I going to switch completely to PARP, or am I just going to continue bevacizumab? So I do use the testing to help me make that decision.
When Dr. Weston says stage four, she's referring to pleural effusion, correct?
Pleural effusion or mediastinal disease, any bulky liver disease, I mean, certainly pleural effusion is one to dry up that fluid, just like we would right. be ascites, but also just stage four in general. Yeah, thanks.
So I just want to run through a few of the other questions that we asked, just as things to think about. I guess one of the issues there isn't much debate about. So this question says, in which of the following situations is it standard that everybody is going to use a PARP inhibitor? And I think the answer is B. There's a lot of debate about people who don't have BRCA germline, but there's no debate about that. Standard of care. Another question we had is, and at this point you should know the answer, which of the following is approved in patients who don't have BRCA mutations of any type, somatic, anything? And the answer to that is niraparib. That was the approval we just showed you. So there is that option. You're not going to get as much benefit as you go down the line, less BRCA-ness or less mutation, but there's still some benefit. We mentioned the fact that if you want to use bevacizumab and a PARP inhibitor, so for example, let's say somebody with a BRCA germline and ascites, right now, in terms of FDA approvals, it's going to have to be olaparib. So I guess at this point, Dave, are we substituting other PARP inhibitors or sticking with olaparib if we're going to use Bev, niraparib if it's not BRCA?
Well, you know, this is really the question that we're facing right now, which is what will the payers reimburse? I try to stick to the label. Why bring that uncertainty in? And I also try to stick with the data. So the data with regards to Bev and olaparib is the combination approval. You know, one thing that is so important, I think you said this, Neil, was that was the only trial that had an active comparator. All the other trials had versus placebo. So the benefit we're seeing was versus a known approved agent, Bev. So when we look at this, I do try to stick with the label. I look at those patients, not just who are BRCA positive. In my mind, that's very straightforward. Those all get PARP. Now, if I have a high-risk patient that Shannon referred to, I would consider continuing the Bev. But there's another group of patients that's HRD positive, but really the FDA indication is genomic instability. So that includes the commercially available Myriad test, which looks at HRD, while I prefer getting the entire or a bigger picture for all these mutations. So I use usually Foundation Medicine, but there's all the commercially available. And the Foundation Medicine gives you this loss of heterozygosity, which is also considered genomic instability. So those areas, I can use that test to get more information and then base my use of the olaparib and Bev in that genomic unstable patient population.
So I want to move on and talk about another case, and then we're going to move on to the use of checkpoint inhibitors in gynecologic cancers. But just a couple other quick points I want to make from questions that we asked. So we asked, which of the following has demonstrated benefit combined with chemotherapy? And there's only one that's been looked at, that's veliparib. We showed you that before. And again, it looked like similar benefits. We're trying to point out for you areas where people agree, and there's lots of areas where people are arguing right now. So this is one of them. So we're trying to kind of separate out the stuff that everybody agrees to and everybody's arguing about. Just one other issue that I think we mentioned already, the fact that the duration of treatment, at least in the trials, was different and what the implication that may be moving forward. But let's again get back to real life. And Paula, I'm sure we could talk for 25, 30 minutes about this lady. She's so interesting. But maybe you can just kind of focus a little bit on what happened to her when she started the maintenance olaparib. She's a 63-year-old woman, and it looks like she presented initially in April 2018 and ended up getting olaparib. Can you talk a little bit about what happened to her when she got the treatment, Paula, and a little bit about her as a person?
Yes, and it's interesting. I only put the dates in there specifically because before December 2018, we didn't have a maintenance right after chemotherapy. So this was, like you said, the gods were looking out for her. Whereas before it was patients had to have prior therapies or first relapse. But anyway, and we did the Foundation One, not endorsing one company over the other, but for the same reason, she had the loss of heterozygosity, so HRD positive. So we were able to get that approved.
Looking down there to the bottom then, she didn't have a germline mutation, but she had a mutation in the tissue itself.
Exactly.
And so that got her on the olaparib. What happened at that point?
She's a violinist and very active, and she's also conducting. And so initially when she was diagnosed, the biggest thing was, am I going to have peripheral neuropathy due to the carboplatin and the Taxol? So we monitored that very closely, and she did very well. in the sense that she only had grade one. And then we did education with her for the olaparib. And it's interesting because Jennifer will practice differently than I, not right or wrong, just different styles. And the package insert says for olaparib, you want to do a baseline and then check the CBC monthly. Whereas niraparib, because there is a higher incidence of thrombocytopenia, you want to do it weekly for the first month. Because we've used so many PARP inhibitors in clinical trials, I have always treated every patient as if they were on a clinical trial, even though they're not. And I'm so used to treating patients that have been heavily pretreated, so I'm still treating them very conservatively, even though going forward, these patients receiving it in the maintenance setting are going to do much better than all of us who have had this past history of hematological toxicities. But we monitored her CBC weekly for the first month. And then after that, we go to monthly.
I just recommend that you watch Paula's presentation where she goes through every single one of these points. It's a fantastic presentation. But Paula, maybe just to pick one out as a little bit of a teaser, you put in there the issue of fatigue and deconditioning. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so it is interesting. So when we talk about a class effect, so we have nausea and fatigue. And again, is the fatigue due to anemia, thyroid condition, the fact that she had chemotherapy, other comorbidities, that sort of thing. But also many patients are not as active, meaning physically. So they're deconditioned. They haven't been exercising as much as they should, even though we promote that and remind them to do that. So checking the hemoglobin is very important. And also, what's her lifestyle like? So I think that's really important in reminding patients that that fatigue usually is very common initially, but it does lift and plateau. And for patients that we've had to either hold the drug or dose reduce, they notice the difference. It's like, oh yeah, I noticed that my fatigue improved after I held or was dose reduced. So far, she's been on this over a year and we have not had to dose reduce. She is still playing her violin. She's conducting. But again, for those of you that are managing patients on PARP inhibitors, and I think that the generalists in the audience that are listening to us that it's like, well, I don't take care of ovarian cancer patients. These PARP inhibitors are now going to be indicated, if not already, for breast cancer, prostate, pancreatic. So this is going to affect all of us in how we manage our patients. So I think it's really important. Somebody needs to be in charge, and our physicians, of course, are in surgery. So we nurses are the ones, whether it's a practice nurse, a navigator, advanced practice, it's really important that somebody is ordering and managing these labs and knowing how to monitor when do you dose reduce, when do you hold. I think that's really important. And then that constant reinforcement of education. How is the patient feeling?
So yeah, and these are some pictures of her. Of course, this woman gave permission. We found over the years there are many patients who like to kind of make the point that there can be life after cancer. Anything else you want to say about this woman and what it's been like taking care of her, Paula?
Well, it's been a pure delight. She thinks that everything we do is wonderful, and she's just full of energy. Now, it's important to remember, though, she's a stage 3 ovarian cancer, and our goal, of course, is cure. But once she relapses, we know that that changes. So we remind her that we're hoping that this is going to be the treatment that's going to prevent or delay your treatment from coming back. But if it does come back, there are other treatments out there. So we remind our patients a chronic illness, and even if it's not curable, it is treatable. And we have evidence, all of us here today, that every year there's newer and better treatments coming out. And lately, it's been monthly, so that's really exciting.
So I love the comment in the chat room. This is why we do what we do. Yeah, for sure.
Very true.
So yeah, 95-year-old mother. I love that one too.
Yeah, she's
all right. Well, let's move on now. Conducting the orchestra. Wow, incredible.
Yeah, while on her olaparib.
What a story. Okay, so a couple other points, and then we're going to move on and talk about checkpoint inhibitors. And the issue, we were talking before about cytopenias, Jennifer, and I think we already mentioned the fact that counts are recommended weekly with niraparib. I'm curious what you've seen in terms of anemia, Jenny. You know, it's been said that, I don't know whether there's more anemia with olaparib than the other ones, but just in general, how often you need to do transfusions, how much of a problem anemia is in patients on PARP inhibitors?
You know, I think a grade 1 anemia is fairly common, maybe even grade 2, but I rarely have to transfuse someone on a PARP inhibitor. And to echo Paula's point, we also keep track of everyone that's on a PARP inhibitor, all of our patients. We have a list going, and we also, for niraparib, obviously do weekly labs. And then for, it kind of depends on the patient for the other PARPs, you know, if they've had a tough time with their chemo and they're pancytopenic or we're trying to recover their bone marrow, maybe we will test weekly for a while, but eventually we get them to go monthly.
So a couple other points, and then we're going to move on and actually talk about some other issues related to PARP inhibitors. We mentioned about the hematologic toxicity, and you can see there are 3 approved PARP inhibitors, rucaparib used with recurrent disease, but you see some degrees of cytopenias with all these. You see some degree of GI toxicity. We talked about that as well. Shannon, what about dose adjustment? These are the potential dose adjustments. What are some of the issues that cause you to do dose adjustments for these drugs, and can you usually find a dose that a patient's going to be comfortable on?
Yeah, you know, I think this comes down to counseling, and I think both Paula and Jenny have touched on this. A lot of times these patients are transitioning from chemotherapy to the PARP inhibitors, and you get that whole just a pill syndrome where they think, oh, I'm going on a pill, it's going to be no problem. And so with appropriate pre-treatment counseling, you can let them know that it's going to take a month or two to kind of get them to their sweet spot. And that sweet spot may be top dose, or it may be a reduced dose. And we have very clear protocols around that. And so I think as long as you've got good communication and you've really kind of set the stage, then you can help a patient find their best dose. I would say, I agree with Jenny, a lot of these are just grade 1 and 2. And so we don't end up needing to do any type of dose reduction. I would say for me personally, in my practice, when I get a grade 3-4 fatigue, that's when I'm really needing to do a dose reduction. And importantly, you have to interrupt the dose first, give them a break, let them recuperate, and then go ahead and reduce their dose. My Italian hands are getting a little excessive here in the webinar. So I think, you know,
for me, that was one of your kids underneath.
So I literally am just flinging my hands around. The fatigue is the one reason that I find most commonly that I need to do a true dose reduction, aside from, say, if I have a patient on like 300 of niraparib and I need to reduce the dose for a thrombocytopenia event.
We're going to move on in a second and talk about checkpoint inhibitors, but I guess there was a question in the chat room about why PARP inhibitors actually cause myelosuppression. Dave, maybe you can comment on that, because these agents do affect the bone marrow, and there also have been concerns about the potential increase of MDS, myelodysplastic syndrome, and AML. What do we know about PARP inhibitors in the bone marrow, Dave?
Neil, you have this wonderful ability to always ask me a question. I have no idea what the answer is. I saw that pop up and I said, I have no idea why these are calling bone marrow. It's affecting every cell in the body. And I think we look at that. Now, interestingly, if we look at the BRCA patients, because theoretically the BRCA patients, because every cell is impacted, would have a higher rate of side effect and toxicity. And that doesn't seem to be the case. Now, I do think an important point coming out of the most recent presentation at ASCO with regards to SOLO2 and their survival advantage. So we finally have now marked survival improvement in SOLO2, which was the recurrent setting, which is not what we're talking about here. But an interesting aspect of those findings were that the AML in myelodysplastic syndrome was 8% in the treatment arm and 4% in the placebo arm. So markedly higher than previously been reported. In the past, about 1.5% was the highest that we'd seen, 0.5 to 1.5%. So why is it happening? I don't think I can answer that question, but it is happening, something we always need to counsel a patient. A patient should not be put on PARP without counseling about AML and myelodysplastic disorder.
Although to me, like in a basic level, we know it affects DNA, you know, right. DNA and MDS, you know, you could see in the same sentence. But I think it's also important to remember SOLO2 had an incredible survival benefit. That was the use of olaparib in relapse disease. I mean, major benefit. So these people live longer. Correct. And also, it's interesting you mentioned that the control group had 4%. Of course, it could be lower than that. There are not that many patients. But these people get chemotherapy, et cetera, that also damages the bone marrow. Some of them have prior histories because they're BRCA, breast cancer, chemo, et cetera. So we don't have the final answer of that, but certainly there's a lot of interest in it. But we're going to spend the rest of our time in terms of new agents and talking about checkpoint inhibitors. And it seems like almost every conference we do, regardless of the tumor type nowadays, checkpoint inhibitors are coming up. And thankfully, now they're coming up in gynecologic cancers, and it's turning out to be one of the really interesting stories of all the checkpoint inhibitor stories that we're going to tell in this series, particularly the endometrial cancer one is really fascinating. So let's go through that a little bit. We're going to talk about cervical cancer as well. So a couple of questions just to warm up, but I was also experimenting with these kinds of questions. Tell us if you like these kinds of questions. So this actually is a true statement. We were just kind of curious whether people are aware of it. And it's interesting, Paula, that the most common gynecologic cancer is ovarian, but so far checkpoint inhibitors have not been that helpful with ovarian. They're not approved. They're not often used. They're a major part, as you're going to see, about cervical and endometrial. But right now, we're waiting to see whether or not we can find a better way to use checkpoint inhibitors in endometrial cancer. So here's where it starts to get really interesting. And Paula, maybe you can react to this, which is metastatic endometrial cancer. So maybe before we even get started, Shannon, you can talk a little bit about the path a patient with endometrial cancer takes to get to the point of metastatic disease. And then Paula, you can talk about what happens after that.
Sure. There's going to be really two paths. There's one that a patient is actually diagnosed up front with stage 3 or 4 disease. This is considered metastatic and would be treated as such. Then there's another path, and more commonly, patients with endometrial cancer are diagnosed with early stage disease, which typically can be cured with surgery alone, with or without radiotherapy. However, there's a proportion of patients that will have a recurrence, and that patient will then be considered metastatic. So those are the two lines that we see. Both are considered chemotherapy naive.
So, and I guess then the question is, where do checkpoint inhibitors fit in? And again, before Paula talks about the sequence, let me stick with you, Shannon, in terms of trying to figure out what direction to go with a patient who has endometrial cancer. So many times in oncology, there's a key biomarker that really is going to push you in one direction. Our last program on CLL, we were talking about 3 biomarkers that drive what happens in CLL. In terms of 17P, P53, and IGVH. Well, I would say, Shannon, in endometrial cancer, the measurement of MSI is what really drives the management of endometrial cancer. And rather than showing a whole bunch of technical things about MSI, I wonder if you could just explain, as if you're on round, Shannon, what MSI is and why it's so important to determine in patients like this.
Yeah, so MSI is something called microsatellite instability. And basically what we're looking at, it's similar to PARP in that we're looking at DNA damage repair and specifically at proteins involved with mismatch repair. So it's just a different abnormality that can happen. Again, in that train track, it's just one little flip and you look to see if that patient's tumor has any evidence of that. And it can be done in a couple of different ways, but it's very easy. And it's interesting because this was a controversy. What do you think, Dr. O'Malley, about 4 or 5 years ago, should we be testing all patients for this, specifically to look for Lynch syndrome, which is a hereditary syndrome that you can see endometrial, colon, and the like. Once immune checkpoint inhibition came on, then you could use that as a decision-making point for treatment. And then the controversy went away. And now really we're seeing routinely all patients are being tested for this.
So, and I guess in a way you could, in a weird way, similar to BRCA, you can either have a germline MSI situation, MSI high, or you can have somatic. But the bottom line is that if they have it, not just endometrial cancer, cancer of the colon, there are other cancers. If they have it, they're very sensitive to checkpoint inhibitors. And so, Paula, getting back to the normal sequence, what we see is that if you look at, in terms of MSI high endometrial cancer, theoretically, you give chemotherapy first and then a checkpoint inhibitor. Second line, you could give it first, but only give it to people with high PD-1 levels. And that's actually, we'll talk about that. And that's the model in cervical cancer. You could give the combination of Pembro and Lenvatinib second line in endometrial cancer, MSI high. We'll talk about that. Or you could start out with a checkpoint inhibitor. And Paula, right now, I think it's option A. I think most people MSI high are going to get chemo. And then they're going to get pembrolizumab, but not with anything else. And
you got the gold star.
Just kind of curious, Paula, how people do when they go through that path, so to speak.
Well, receiving pembrolizumab, patients do very well, much better than they do with chemotherapy. But back to what Dr. Weston said, I think sometimes we forget that not everybody's in an academic setting. And so even though standard of care for checking for microsatellite instability or the loss of the MMR gene, which can just be done in pathology. But if you get a patient that is a second opinion or transfers to you and looking at that pathology report, that might not have been done because it might have been sent out to a lab. So it's really important for the audience to know that they want to be checking the pathology for that testing. It's easy, inexpensive, and you get the results back really quickly. But moving forward, so the patient's frontline would get chemotherapy plus or minus radiation or radiation plus chemosensitizer. But when they recur, we don't really have a standard of care. There are chemotherapies that we could give, but now I think Dr. O'Malley did the keynote 158 with pembrolizumab for MSI high. So patients that have an absence of one of the mismatch repair genes. So we give this every 3 weeks. Patients tolerate it really well. I had one patient that was on over 2 years and very few side effects. Now, we know with immunotherapy, patients most commonly would have like a diarrhea or colitis. We need to check thyroid function, that sort of thing. They can have fatigue. And then some of our patients who tend to already be overweight due to endometrial cancer, that might have been the risk factor. Diabetes could be an issue as well.
Jenny, we know from, again, seeing MSI-high tumors, not just endometrial cancer, but other cancers, that most of these patients actually respond and they respond well. I'm just curious what your experience, have you treated a patient with just pembrolizumab alone and endometrial cancer? I think actually one of your cases, I'm not sure if that's one you're presenting. Any comments though about how people tolerate pembro in this situation, Jenny, and particularly how they respond?
Yeah, so I agree with Paula. I think it's much better tolerated than traditional chemotherapy, with the exception if you do get toxicity, sometimes it can be really bad, the colitis, the pneumonitis, that type of thing. But I'm thinking of one patient in particular that was on pembrolizumab for about 2 years for recurrent endometrial cancer, and she is no evidence of disease now. And it's funny, the panel, the messaging just asked a question, do we limit the time on pembrolizumab? And I said, no. But in this case, this patient wanted to come off. She had had enough of coming every 3 weeks. We couldn't see her disease anymore. She was doing excellent. She wanted to get back full-time working. And she had a little bit of weight gain, a little bit of fatigue. But yeah, in general, people do great.
So also the other group of patients are MS stable. So we know the MSI patients respond really well, Dave, but historically the MS stable patients did not respond to just single agent PD-1 inhibitor. And it wasn't until we saw these combinations, and the one that's approved right now for MS stable endometrial cancer is pembro and lenvatinib. What's the story behind that, Dave? Why people decided to look at this combination and why has it worked so well?
So, you know how I struggle with pronouncing some of these drugs. So this has become Len-Pem in my mind. I've been struggling with lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. So Len-Pem, you were really looking at how do we increase the immunogenicity of these tumors, and the antivascular lenvatinib drug, which is a pan-TKI or tyrosine kinase inhibitor, seems to potentially increase the immunogenicity. Now, interesting, when we studied lenvatinib by itself, very modest response rates. But when we combine it with other agents like pembro in this scenario, we're seeing almost miraculous response rates. When we look at the clinical benefit rate, we're looking at greater than 80% of microsatellite stable patients are benefiting. Remember, these are often our highest risk patients, those serous cancer, those clear cell cancers. We often don't get any response in the second line, and we're seeing 80% plus clinical benefit rate on these patients.
So we want to get to another case. I'm just going to flip through a couple other slides just to give you something to think about. I asked this question because I started to hear people saying that lenvatinib causes a loss of weight. I think you told me that, Dave. So just to let you know the answer here, 8% of the audience, most of the audience has not used lenvatinib. I think 85% said they hadn't used it. But of the 16% who've used it, half of them have seen weight loss. So we won't talk about it. Just look for it. You know, it's interesting that you all are seeing it. Nobody knows why it happens. Another issue that we can talk a lot about maybe after the cases is the issue of the hypertension that you see with this regimen, which is much more severe and much more rapidly onset than you see with bevacizumab. Usually not a reason to go off therapy as long as you kind of are aware of the fact. And just to take a quick look at some of the data, we've been looking at waterfall plots throughout this series. We know that each one of these is a patient. When it goes down, that's good. It means it's shrinking. So this is MSI high endometrial cancer just getting pembro. Now you see Dave's name at the bottom. It was his study that he presented at the ESMO meeting last year. You think you'll ever go back to ESMO, Dave? Think we're going to be traveling anymore?
I hope so. They just made it remote again. I was looking forward to going to Madrid.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll see. Anyhow, they're trying to say we're going to have to go to ASH for real, but I don't think so. Anyhow, here's what Dave was talking about with the MS stable patients. And you can see again now with the combination, I think that's what this is. Oh, no, this is MSI high also. You see the same combination. All right. Let's talk about how it plays out in real life. And Jenny, you have a 68-year-old lady. Maybe we can just focus on what happened when she got the pembrolizumab, what kind of condition she was in, what you told her about, and kind of how you managed her.
Yeah, so this is a patient with recurrent endometrial cancer. She has MSS, so she's stable. And we started her after completing a clinical trial with avelumab and talazoparib. She progressed with just slightly on trial, but enough to kick her off. So we said, hey, we can give her an IO on label. So we did the pembro plus lenvatinib. We start our patients, I think the starting dose is 20 milligrams. We usually start everyone at 10 because of the toxicities we've been seeing. And then maybe after 3 days, a week or so, then we will increase to 14, maybe 18. Although I've never gotten anyone there, to be honest. I'm curious to see if anyone else has. So she experienced hypertension fairly quickly after increasing her dose to 14 milligrams, which is typical. She messaged me one morning. Her blood pressure was pretty high, 180 over 116. She wasn't symptomatic. Over the course of the day, we finally got her blood pressure under control with two different agents, which is also typical. And then, let's see, I think the slide up right now is about a week or two later, her blood pressure was stable. So that was good. But she was telling me she's feeling awful, no energy, no interest in doing anything, not exercising, no appetite. I mean, this sounds horrible, right? This is the woman, she has grandkids and a lake house and a very active person. So this just was not compatible with her goals. So what we did was hold her drug for about a week. She started to feel a lot better. We also did labs at that time and we obtained a thyroid function test and we did note that she was hypothyroid. So this could have been from either lenvatinib or pembro. We don't know, but I was able to start her on some thyroid replacement. And I mean, this was only like a week or two ago, but she's doing okay. And we did restart her back on 10 milligrams rather than the 14 milligrams.
And, you know, through the course of this series, Thursday night when we get to lung, we'll be talking a lot about checkpoint inhibitor toxicity. Certainly hypothyroidism is a very common problem. We can go into the next case, but Jenny, maybe you can just comment on her as a person. That henna tattoo looks pretty.
Yeah, so I love this slide. This is when she had her initial chemotherapy. She obviously lost her hair and had a henna tattoo of a lily. And this was in remembrance of one of her granddaughters who she lost to SIDS a couple years back. That's her lake house I talked about. When her hair grew back, she dyed it purple. Those are her grandkids. So she's just a wonderful person and full of life. And I love this quote. When I was telling her I was going to present her, she was super excited. And she sent me all these pictures. And she said at the end of our conversation, I'm old, I'm short, and sometimes feel invisible. That's why I dyed my hair purple. Thank you for making me feel seen and heard, which I thought was just a great, yeah, exactly. Dr. Romali's clapping right now. So that was a really good nursing moment.
So yeah, lots of moments like that in oncology. Let's just briefly hear about another patient who got this combination. It's always good to talk to people. We have new combinations that come out. I remember when pembro and lenvatinib came out, there was a lot of nervousness in the gynecologic oncology community. Lenvatinib had hardly been used at all at that point. But now I think things are settling in a little bit. What happened with this 67-year-old woman, Paula, particularly when she got the lenvatinib?
Yeah, so she was a transfer patient for us. She lived in Philadelphia and she was living alone and not doing well. And so they started her on the standard of care, pembro and 200 milligrams every 3 weeks, and then the lenvatinib, 20 milligrams PO. It's interesting that you start at a lower dose. I think as we learn more about this. I know Dr. O'Malley did the studies, so he's going to be my go-to. But I think about liposomal doxorubicin. We no longer use the FDA dose in niraparib. There's controversy, but so it'll be interesting on this. The other thing is when we order this, I don't know if it's laziness on my part, but even with the olaparib, I don't order the two different doses, nor with this. So I'm just ordering the 10 milligram tablets. And so when we dose reduce, we go down to 10 rather than 14, which is not what the package insert says. But anyway, she presented to us with the standard dose of 200 and then 20 PO, but then she was having toxicity. So her physician in Philadelphia dose reduced her to the 10, which is probably what we would have done. And she responded as far as quality of life goes. She was feeling better. She moved out here because her children lived here. She was a widow living alone. She did have fatigue, but she was able to enjoy her family, her ADLs. But interesting, she stayed on this drug for 6 months, stable disease. And then she presented with bone mets and she just recently passed away. But going off on another tangent, she had 103 temperature during this time. So she was admitted to rule out COVID, which she did not have. And so we knew that she had progressed and they wouldn't discharge her. And my physician is like, what are you talking about? They're like, well, we have to work up the fever. And it's like, oh my gosh, her family can't be with her. This woman is dying. Please let her go home to be with her family because nobody could see her. And those were some of the things during COVID, which were so sad that loved ones couldn't be with their dying family members. She was discharged in stable condition and she died within a month, but she was home with her family. And that was, we take care of these people, but we also want them to die well. We want them to have dignity and also be surrounded by their loved ones. And I didn't mean this to be like sad and everything, but the good news is she had 6 months of quality life that she would not have had had she not had this combination. This was a third line treatment for her.
This is a slide from Paula's talk. I again recommend you take a look at it. She goes through a lot of these thoughts, I think are very interesting and provocative. We're going to talk about cervical cancer in a second, but just circling back to the lenvatinib pembro, Shannon, can you talk a little bit more? I put that question up about comparing the hypertension with Bev. Can you talk a little bit about what you see with this combination in terms of hypertension when the blood pressure goes up? I hear there's some people who give patients hypertensive meds to take home so they don't have to go to the pharmacy if they need them. And how do people feel? This woman had hypothyroidism, but can you see people feeling bad just from the lenvatinib?
From the hypertension standpoint, it's rapid when it happens. It's usually in the first week or so, and it seems much quicker than what we see with bevacizumab, but it does respond to antihypertensives. And so we actually do send patients home with a prescription. They either fill it or they just have the prescription and know they can fill it. We let them kind of decide what they want to do, but we do have that available for them so that they don't have a delay when they do see the blood pressure going up. And we've found that that's been fairly successful. We have a great collaboration with our internal medicine colleagues at my institution, and we all work together to really get things under control. Because again, our goal is to see that 80% clinical benefit that Dr. O'Malley mentioned. And we certainly don't want to lose that just because we can't mitigate the toxicity. From a fatigue standpoint, I agree this patient had some other reasons for fatigue, but we do see pure fatigue just from the combination of the two treatments. And again, this for me is one of the reasons I do the most dose reductions. I said it before with PARP, same thing with the Len-Pem regimen. I think that it's really hard. We don't have a good drug to get people to feel better from a fatigue standpoint. So often you need to pause and do a dose reduction.
So one final question going back to you, Shannon. It's interesting. The last meeting, we were talking about the concept of the bond that heals. The fact that even if you can't slow the tumor down, you still give the patient the relationship, and that means a lot to them. And that comes through when we hear about how you talk about your patients. But I am curious, Jenny, it was mentioned about Pembro being given every 3 weeks, and there was just an approval for every 6 weeks. Seemed like pretty good timing because nowadays people are trying to keep people out of the hospital, keep them from infusion because of COVID. What are you doing in MGH about? Are you going to Q 6 weeks, Jenny?
Yep, we are. For most patients, they have agreed to 6 weeks. We have some patients that say, no, this 3 weeks, it's working beautifully. I don't want to change. You know, you always have those patients. But yeah, we're trying to switch people over. 6 weeks is so much better. But in that context, we still do want to see them more often than 6 weeks, even if it's a quick virtual. We're doing lots of virtual visits now. But yeah, we try in 6 weeks.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hear people talking about doing virtuals on patients who came in to get infusions that they actually don't. Then the patient goes home and then they talk to them on virtual.
Oh, yeah, so, we don't do it that, but.
Yeah, but interesting. Yes. Anyhow, let's finish out talking about, you know, there's a lot of excitement with the endometrial cancer. Checkpoint inhibitors are full blown in there. I think hopefully maybe we'll see them being used first line in the future, particularly with MSI high disease. There was a paper just presented last week at ASCO looking at first line checkpoint inhibitors, MSI high colorectal cancer, I believe.
Yep.
So we'll see, Dave, whether that's going to come to endometrial cancer as well. But let's talk about cervical cancer. Now we have also checkpoint inhibitors as an issue there. So Dave, we said, how is pembrolizumab approved in patients with metastatic cervical cancer? And basically it's patients with higher PD-L1 levels. Maybe you can talk a little bit about this trial, Dave, that you did. It seems like you do almost all the trials here. But anyhow, this trial that ended up getting cervical cancer an approval, even though it wasn't necessarily the most exciting outcome, but at least it's something that a patient can be treated with. What did you see in the study, Dave?
Well, when we looked at part of this giant Keynote 158, and I was not the lead on this study, but I did present the endometrial cancer data at ESMO, but I'll take credit for all of them. I wish I was the lead on all of them, but as I said, I'm not that smart. We have patients, there's 98 cervical cancer patients. Of those 98 cervical cancer patients, 77 of them or 79% of them had PD-L1 positive CPS greater than or equal to 1. So for those who treat lung cancer, it's a different level. In cervix, it's just greater than or equal to the 1%. So when we look at those patients...
And we should mention, we're going to talk on Thursday, in lung cancer, you're looking more at 50% being considered high.
Correct. And so when we look at these patients, again, modest of a 15% response rate. But when we look at cytotoxic therapy, we're talking single agents with higher toxicity. And we also see clinical benefit beyond that 15% response rate that, again, is important in these patients. If they're not overly symptomatic, we can control their disease, even if we don't get that tumor shrinkage.
So I am curious, you know, not that many patients actually have objective responses, as you say, Dave, but are there people, you know, the real, you know, intrigue about checkpoint inhibitors in all these diseases is the possibility that you'll get launched into a long remission. We were talking about stopping people on therapy. Do you see that with cervical cancer? Do you see people getting these 15% or even more prolonged benefit?
Yeah, you know what? I have a couple of patients in my practice who are now at a couple of years, and I have patients in my practice with recurrent uterine cancer who are cured. They've been off checkpoint inhibitor for 3 years with recurrent cervical. I've had to change how I counsel patients about, we're not going to get rid of this disease, which I don't know anymore. Now, in cervix, we'll see this same phenomenon, and you only see about a 2-3% complete response rate, maybe a little bit higher if we look at some trials. But if you get that patient who gets the CR, do we have the chance to cure them? It may be, but it's a challenging question whether or not to stop at 2 years. In my own practice, if they have persistent disease, so I can still see something on the CAT scan, I don't, if that's uterine or cervix, I will continue the pembro beyond 2 years. If they've had a complete response, I have that discussion that many trials have stopped at 2 years, and we have that discussion and often will elect to stop so that we minimize the potential IO toxicity.
So, Shannon, you know, it's really interesting, again, all throughout oncology, try to figure out who's going to respond to some of these new agents. We were talking last week about checkpoint inhibitors in Hodgkin lymphoma and the weird PD-1 amplification they see there. Everybody thought that cervical cancer was going to be like Hodgkin, like super responsive to checkpoint inhibitors because it's a viral-induced disease, and yet that kind of didn't happen. Any thoughts about that, Shannon?
Yeah, I mean, I'm disappointed. I think that we did have high hopes that this was going to look like some of the other tumor types that have that. It's a hot tumor on the scale, but maybe not hot enough. And what we don't understand is what the viral proteins, how they really are involved. I think there's a number of studies now that are looking at taking checkpoint inhibition, but then adding something else, either a vaccine or something that kind of targets the virus to see if we can amplify that response. But yeah, it's better, to David's point, it's better than chemo. So that was something, but it's a pretty low bar.
So just to finish out, we're going to talk a lot in this series about checkpoint inhibitor toxicities. We can talk about it all day long, but I was kind of curious, as checkpoint inhibitors have come into the gynecologic oncology area, different patient, different situation, kind of how it's playing out. And I guess one thing I was kind of curious about, Jenny, is one of the things that we hear from the other melanoma, lung cancer, bladder, et cetera, is the issue of dermatologic skin problems with checkpoint inhibitors, which we hear are fairly common, but not usually that difficult to manage. What are your experience with dermatologic problems, Jenny?
I don't honestly see that many rashes or anything. And if it is, it's usually mild. I don't know what maybe Paula has seen more.
I think you see it more with Ipi as opposed to Pembro. So yeah. I think most of us are just using Pembro in their gynecological
malignancy. Right. I mean, certainly I've seen them, but not
very mild.
Yeah,
that's what we've heard, that they've been mild. We talked about the thyroid problems. Another issue that is not that common but is seen, I think you all referred to it before, there are a couple more serious problems. Colitis, which can occur with checkpoint inhibitors. And for example, if you have a patient on pembro-lenvatinib, is it the pembro or lenvatinib that's going to cause a diarrhea? Because lenvatinib can do that as well, so that could be a problem. But the other thing, Dave, is the issue. We know you can see autoimmune pneumonitis. And of course, again, you guys are sort of just getting started with checkpoint inhibitors. You don't have volumes and volumes of patients the way lung cancer, and you see all these things, not to mention that they have other issues going on in their lungs. But I am curious, Dave, if you have any thoughts about this thing, because one of the things we're starting to hear about is the confusion of working up a patient with a pulmonary problem. Now, again, on Thursday, we're going to talk about lung cancer, much more complicated. But the fact that now COVID-19 is starting to enter into the equation. Dave, any comments?
Well, you know, literally while we were on the prep for this call, I had a call from my nurse practitioner with this exact scenario, presented with increasing shortness of breath, cough, and fever. And so we immediately sent her in for COVID testing, which was negative, and now presumed pneumonitis. So she's literally undergoing the workup and evaluation at this time. But with the availability in most centers, large centers at least, with the availability of COVID testing at this point and the turnaround being faster, you can really do these in series depending on your concern. Put them in isolation, rule out COVID, and start your workup of pneumonitis. Obviously, you do not want to start high-dose steroids if they have a COVID infection. So with that, it really can be done. Would I not start an immune therapy because of concern for COVID? Absolutely. I would give the patient the IO if it was indicated and deal with the potential risk of ruling out COVID.
So I'll tell you, the four of you, something that a lot of the people in the audience know, which is on, speaking of COVID, on Thursday when we did CLL, Dr. Jeff Sharman from US Oncology was about to publish a paper. He wouldn't talk about it because it was published on Friday. It was the use of ibrutinib to treat COVID-19. So we couldn't get him to talk about it, but we did an interview. So if you go back to our podcast that I told you about before, Oncology Today is 30 minutes of Jeff Sharman from Thursday night talking about ibrutinib to treat people in the ICU on ventilators with COVID-19. Not CLL, not cancer, awesome. COVID-19. So take a listen to that. You want to hear something really interesting. Anyhow, let's finish out with another case, another jump into reality. And Jenny, you have a 35-year-old woman who's a personal trainer. What happened with her?
Yeah, so in the interest of time, I'll just kind of briefly go through. So she presented with some postcoital bleeding. She eventually got a biopsy of her cervix and was found to have cervical cancer. She underwent her surgery and was on active surveillance. Unfortunately, she did recur about a year and a half, 2 years later. And it was sort of a big recurrence, unfortunately. So she was pretty symptomatic. She went on Ipi/Nivo, speaking of rashes, and she did have one, mild rash, mild fatigue, mild cough.
We should clarify that ipilimumab is another checkpoint inhibitor that was originally used in melanoma. And now research is being done with two checkpoint inhibitors. So she went on that trial.
She did, yeah. And she did pretty well for 5 months or so, just stable disease, but better quality of life than she had on chemotherapy. Unfortunately, she presented with some headaches and kind of some strange mental status changes. So we sent her for a brain MRI. It showed multiple brain mets. She was kicked off trial for that, unfortunately, but she did have positive PD-L1 staining. So we were able to give her pembrolizumab. She unfortunately passed away a couple months later. But I will say her quality of life while on the immunotherapy, although I don't know if it actually prolonged her life at all, it was better than it was on cytotoxic traditional chemotherapy. So that was kind of a blessing for her, I think.
I said it was a acalabrutinib in COVID-19, right? BTK inhibitor. Yes. Okay. Because somebody in the chat room said I didn't mention the name. Yeah, it was a acalabrutinib. Anyhow, anything you want to say about this woman tragically dying of the disease?
It's cervical cancer is such a sad, sad disease. And, you know, when it comes back, it's terrible. And she was young. She's 30. She's around my age. She had kids. So I really felt for her and related to her. And as nurses, this is what we do. We get them through. We, as Paula said earlier, let them die with dignity. And that's part of being an oncology nurse.
Any comment, Dave? I guess theoretically, you could say this was a potentially preventable cancer.
I'm losing my hair on this, Neil. I think that this disease is preventable. I'm so sick of watching 30-year-old women die of metastatic cervical cancer. It is where our options, vaccines should be given. You know, it's now indicated up to age 45. This is disease that we can prevent, and we need to remember that it's a cancer prevention vaccine. That's it.
Also, and someone in the chat room mentioned pap smears in terms of earlier detection. Any final comments, Jenny, about taking care of this patient?
I would just say, like all oncology patients, everyone sort of has their goals with life, and hers was to stay active. She was a personal trainer. Unfortunately, she got a psoas muscle mass that prevented her from doing a lot, but we were able to coach her through. And I think that's really the privilege of taking care of these patients, getting them through their lives, and whether they're short or long, it's really been a privilege.
So thank you, the faculty, for such a great job tonight. Thank you all for attending.